we should add, too. We talked about Robert Vesco in Radio Free America number 25. We will be dealing with many of the Vesco connections to the Iran-Contra scandal and the drug smuggling and terror aspects of that same scandal in a three-part series, probably 4 hours each, that we're going to be doing in May during the KFJC Month of Mayhem. Continuing with heroin, the Great Heroin Coup by Henrik Krueger. In these 8 points, we find the will, the power, and the motives, not for the once proclaimed victory over the traffickers, but for the dramatic transfer of underworld power that suddenly became a reality in 1973. The syndicate was in on it, the White House, the CIA, and special lobby groups were in on it too, at least indirectly. But we still need to ask who in particular and why. We will rely on logic and guesswork only to identify individual accomplices and their particular contributions and motives. Let us first consider the Lansky Syndicate, represented by Santo Trafficante and his Cuban narcotics mafia. In addition to motives he might have shared with the CIA, Trafficante had many other reasons to take part in the heroin coup. First, it meant cheaper heroin deliveries and therefore greater profits. Second, he wanted the Corsicans out because, behind his and the rest of the syndicate's backs, they had begun setting up their own U.S. distribution network. Finally, Trafficante's drug mob did not want to see a repeat of BNDD Operation Eagle, U.S. Drug Enforcement's last effective raid against his network. What were the possibilities for Trafficante's playing an active role in the coup's execution, apart from preparation of the Southeast Asia and Mexico-based networks? Without help from the CIA and powerful lobbies, his chances were slim. With their assistance, he could infiltrate the narcotics nerve center, the White House. Here, we might discuss just who, in fact, helped him. If it is true that Trafficante fought the Corsicans so bitterly from 1971 on, how can it be that Marcel Boucan, B-O-U-C-A-N, and his shrimp boat were seized in February 1972 with 425 kilos of pure heroin en route to Trafficante in Florida? There is only one explanation, which Boucan himself offered in court, that Boucan was set up by his American client. How else can the unprecedented seizure by French customs following a tip from the CIA be explained? If it was a plot to exhaust the stocks of the remaining French heroin rings and thereby cause panic among the Corsicans, then it worked. How guilty was Richard Nixon, who presided over the heroin coup? Personally, I believe that under strong pressure, he was a more or less willing tool rather than the force behind it all. Pointing to Nixon's guilt or his close association with the Cuba lobby, with people connected to Lansky and Trafficante, and with Robert Vesco. In addition, his dirty tricks department relied heavily on Cuban exiles. The Cubans would never have supported him with dangerous criminal acts, demonstrations, donations, and votes if he had really been out to eliminate their most profitable business. Nixon would have been ruining the Cuban mafia, and to an extent the syndicate as well, and thereby his friends in Florida. He would have been digging his own grave. Thus, Nixon tackled the drug problem as he did every political problem. He followed the path of least resistance. And that meant ignoring his criminal allies in Florida and Southeast Asia while he hounded the Corsicans, who had no constituency, to death.
Continuing. That Nixon might have been involved in the heroin coup for his own personal gain is lent credence by the following quote from Dan Mulday's respective book, The Hoffa Wars, published Charter Books, 1978. Quote, a former Nixon aide, not privy to the Hague investigation, says that one of his associates in the White House mentioned to him sometime, quote, during the impeachment summer, unquote, that someone high up, maybe White House Chief of Staff Haig, was interested in Nixon's, quote, possible organized crime involvements. That conversation involved, quote, a massive payoff from those in, quote, Army Service Club scandals in Vietnam, unquote, during 1969 or 70. The aide says that the service club ripoffs, quote, involved the mafia and millions of dollars, and that the main focus of the interest by, quote, someone high up in the White House was on whether the top mafia guy, unquote, who ran, quote, all these things in Southeast Asia had made payoffs to Nixon. The crime figure, he says, was, quote, the one who was apparently known as the so-called mastermind or architect of the Southeast Asian drug trade, who was very powerful and very well known as a mob leader. According to government narcotics experts, the central figure in the Indochina Golden Triangle narcotics traffic was Santos Trafficante, unquote. In my opinion, the central manipulator in the whole narcotics scheme was the CIA, or rather a faction within it. It is erroneous to treat the agency as a monolith. Various lobby groups have their own agents in the company, generating internal power struggles that reflect political polarizations external to the CIA. There are, doubtless, CIA factions wholeheartedly in favor of ending America's policeman and oppressor roles and in favor of social democratic rather than right-wing regimes. Equally certain is the fact that one should take the agency's new, outwardly benign face with a grain of salt. Within the agency, there remain powerful groups promoting continued support of, quote, old friends in Latin America and Southeast Asia. The China-Cuba lobby has traditionally been one of the most influential within the CIA, and there is little reason to believe that the situation has seriously changed. Finally, the agency has laid low of late, as the Carter administration has lobbied for a relaxation of constraints placed upon it by Congress in the wake of the 70s exposés of CIA horror stories. In addition to, or rather behind, the CIA's new official policy, there is also an unofficial one. It manifests itself in such matters as the manipulation of the DEA to perform what previously had been CIA dirty work, and in the toleration, if not encouragement, of a large, apparently independent army of Cuban exile terrorists, available for action in Latin America at the request of the presiding dictators. The evidence suggests that the forces behind the unofficial policy were able to place many of their loyal CIA agents in the DEA, and in such private intelligence agency covers as Intertel and Wackenhut, where they continue their tasks while letting the agency wash its hands. Intelligence is still gathered by the CIA, but some of the dirtiest operations are now performed by, quote, former agents. Let's just exaggerate that last point again, because it's a very important one for what we've been talking about, and it's going on right this very moment. The evidence suggests, Kruger writes, that the forces behind the unofficial policy were able to place many of their loyal CIA agents in the DEA, and in such private intelligence agency covers as Intertel and Wackenhut, where they continue their tasks while letting the agency wash its hands. Intelligence is still gathered by the CIA, but some of the dirtiest operations are now performed by, quote, former agents, unquote. And let's bear that very strongly in mind in light of the current Iran-Contra scandal with people like Ed Wilson currently in jail in Texas for doing basically what other people have also been doing, all of them working legally for the agency, but with the agency maintaining the shield of deniability.
So again, what we're looking at here are former, unquote, CIA agents working for the DEA, not only here, to eliminate the Corsican competition with the Nixonal and Lansky-allied Santo Trafficante mob, also CIA-allied, but more importantly, or not, I shouldn't say more importantly, but also, as we're going to be looking at in the broadcast, using those same organizations, basically the National Security Establishment was using those same organizations to implement right-wing terror throughout the world, Latin America in particular. Continuing with Henry Kruger's account. We cannot, of course, discount the possibility that the unofficial policy is in fact executed by former agents who had either been purged from the agency or left in protest against its more moderate line. However, that implies that a renegade CIA faction now runs an independent secret service aided by lobby interests, i.e. not Intertel, but an even more powerful third force. If that is so, I can come up with only one lobby group with the relevant motives as well as the power to back them, the World Anti-Communist League, or WACL. WACL can mobilize CIA agents closely associated with the China, Cuba, Chile lobby, especially the large contingent of former agents of the Galen-Vlasov organization, the intelligence agency run by Hitler's master spy Reinhard Galen, which became the BND, the West German equivalent of the CIA. E. Howard Hunt was clearly the China-Cuba-Latin America lobby's man. That he is also tied to WACL is suggested by the fact that William F. Buckley, Hunt's close friend for 20 years and the godfather of his children, was one of WACL's top U.S. supporters. Also connected to the same lobby groups are Lucien Conin and the State Department's former intelligence chief, Ray S. Klein, who continues to be a frequent guest at the Taiwan WACL stronghold. Hunt and Conin were the vital forces behind the White House's great heroin coup. Hunt secured the Cuban exiles their necessary footing, and he got his friends Bernard Barker and Manuel Artime to set up hit teams to kidnap and murder Latin American narcotics traffickers. According to Frank Sturgis, those traffickers included members of Auguste Ricord and Christian David's Grupo Francais. Hunt persuaded Egil Crow to bring CIA agents into the White House narcotics apparatus. He told Crow that he knew, quote, key CIA officers who could be temporarily detached from the agency and employed by the new liaison group. It was Hunt who recommended Lucien Conin to head the group. Finally, It was intelligence reports from the CIA and Conine's group which made White House narcotics actions focus almost exclusively on the Corsicans. Conine's close friend, Mitch Werbel III, told journalist Jim Hogan he, quote, found it difficult to believe that a lifelong spy of Conine's stature could ever really leave the CIA. Accustomed to the use of other government agencies as CIA covers, Werbel quite naturally held open the possibility that Conine's DEA job was no more than an exercise in sheep-dipping the backgrounds and identities of the Dirty Dozen, all of whom were CIA veterans, unquote. But a desire to help its old friends in Southeast Asia and Latin America was not the CIA's only motive for promoting the heroin coup. The Gaullists in France, including their loyal adherents in intelligence agency SDECE and their dirty tricksters in SAC, were, in the de Gaulle era, the CIA's arch-enemies as well as rivals for control of the world heroin trade. One can well imagine the CIA joining forces with Georges Pompidou and other pro-U.S. forces in France in crushing the old Gaullist intelligence network. In 1973, with the Corsicans finally pushed out of the picture, the White House reorganized the narcotics effort to form the DEA. Almost immediately, heroin began flowing to the U.S. from new sources of supply. Journalist Ron Rosenbaum cites the following statement by a U.S. customs official, quote, BNDD and customs are finally getting somewhere. They break up the French connection. They're getting big conspiracy cases. Suddenly, they, the White House, step in and there's this big shakeup. And by the time people get back to work, the Mexican connection is set up, protected, and doing big business. What's that say to you? Unquote. He might have added that the Southeast Asian connection was also protected and doing big business. The emergence of the DEA was the next-to-last phase of the heroin coup. Hunt and Conine's CIA agents moved into the DEA intelligence operations, Conine locating 12 Latino CIA agents in his special operations group. The Dirty Dozen was officially created to combat Cuban and Latin American narcotic smugglers, allegedly following the assassination approach conceived in the darkest corners of the White House.
It must have been a gag. Conine's forces were apparently directed for the most part against small-time independents who had competed with the big-time traffickers in on the heroin coup. The biggest Cuban network, Centro Traficantes, went untouched. Miami's 1974-75 murder wave in Little Havana might even have been connected to the activities of Conine's Cubans. The victims had opposed Orlando Bosch's drive for solidarity in terrorism, a drive which, as suggested by writer Hogan, that's Jim Hogan, author of Spooks, etc., a drive which, as suggested by writer Hogan, might well have enjoyed the support of Traficante and Robert Vesco. Of the latter two, certainly the first and quite possibly the second as well, were central figures in the heroin coup. That brings us to the last, the political phase of the heroin coup, which began with the DEA's 1974 takeover of the CIA's Latin American torture and repression apparatus, and ended with the 1976 creation of CORU, C-O-R-U, Bosch's terrorist mercenary army. Quote, ended is, however, the incorrect word, since the brutalities financed by the heroin coup continue. The DEA, or that part of it penetrated by the CIA, protects the major narcotics dealers. The latter, in turn, support, financially and through gun running, anti-communist paramilitary groups which work hand-in-hand with Latin American police and military forces whose death squads and torturers are supervised by agents of the DEA. I'm going to read that last part again because this describes exactly what is turning up about the Contra connection. The DEA, or that part of it penetrated by the CIA, protects the major narcotics dealers. The latter, in turn, support, financially and through gun running, anti-communist paramilitary groups, which work hand-in-hand with Latin American police and military forces whose death squads and torturers are supervised by agents of the DEA. The infiltration of the DEA and the variety of political assignments for its agents have caused such violent splits within the Bureau that one can speak of two wings which fight one another. One wing carries out guns for drugs and protection programs. The other tries desperately to combat the drug traffic carried out or protected by the first. Among the expressions of this bitter internal strife, apparently, are the Cecilia Falcone and Werbel cases, and the dismissal of DEA Director Bartels for suspected corruption. Recently, the use of drug profits to finance right-wing terrorism has been placed in a new perspective by revelations of Cuban exile teamwork with European and Latin American fascists, and the economic support of WACL for the same anti-communist groups. And that brings us to the final link in the chain of drugs, intelligence, and fascism. And by the way, as we mentioned, this book was written in 1980 about events largely happening between 1970 and 1979. But indeed, as we keep pointing out, as we point out many times tonight, these are the exact same events that are going on now. It's almost the same team. Certainly Shackley, Kleins, Frank Turple et al. Are all the same people.
Members of the Bosch Organization, anti-Castro Cubans, veterans of Brigade 2506. And it's worth noting, too, that in the next section of that great heroin coup that we're going to be talking about, a chapter, that Crewe recalls the Miami conspiracy, many of the anti-Castro Cubans and CIA-related groups that are performing many of the acts we're going to be talking about, that at the time they were doing it, George Bush was director of the CIA. He now, of course, is vice president, but his name has been cropping up in a big way, although it has been submerged from the public spotlight to a considerable extent, not to mix a metaphor. But George Bush is one of the main names to think about here. We're going to be talking about George Bush in, again, the 3-4-hour programs that we're going to be doing in May on the Iran-Contra scandal. We'll be reprising certain features of the material we're putting up here, and we'll be focusing on George Bush and many of the narcotic smuggling connections to this whole scam in May.
Okay. As Dave mentioned, this is we're going to go on now, and we're going to continue and with Kruger's final link in the conspiracy. And specifically, we're going to talk about, among other things, the Miami office, and again, mentioning George Bush. Don't forget George Bush's long sojourn down there with the Drug Task Force, which Frank Turple, a man who, as we've said before, whose veracity is questionable, but whose insider information is not, Frank Turple suggested that what George Bush was doing was helping to continue the CIA's past habit of using the DEA to inject CIA agents directly into the Latin American drug and gun politics.
Okay, now, again, we're going to be dealing with a chapter of the Great Heroin Coup, the concluding chapter before the postscript, this called the Miami Conspiracy. Early in 1980, Alan Pringle, head of the DEA's Miami office, told an Associated Press reporter that Miami banks constitute, quote, the Wall Street, unquote, of the drug dealers. To the reader of this book, that should come as no surprise. Nor should Patrice Cheroff's claim to me that Miami was the main station of the fascist front organization World Service. Yet the significance of Miami in the netherworld of international fascism remains one of America's better-kept secrets. In June of 1976, Hervé de Vatère, V-A-T-H-A-I-R-E, the financial director for Mirage jet manufacturer Marcel Dassault, spent a week in Miami together with Soldier of Fortune Jean Kay of Spain's neo-fascist Paladin Group. While there, they had several meetings with Cuban exiles. Upon their return to France, the two disappeared with over $1.5 million in aircraft corporation funds. It was then reported that the money went to support Christian phalangists fighting in Lebanon, but some French observers believe it financed two great French bank robberies. On the weekend of July 17th and 18th, 1976, 20 men set out on an expedition through the sewers of Nice to the Société Générale Bank. There, they stole upwards of $10 million. When the robbery's mastermind, Albert Spaggiari, S-P-A-G-G-I-A-R-I, was arrested that October, he fingered La Catena, a cover name for a coalition of Spanish and Italian fascists, the Paladin Group in particular. Most of the take went to finance their operations. A second sewer heist was executed in August of 1976, this time at the Société Générale Paris branch on Île Saint-Louis. The amount was $5 million. Immediately after the Nice heist, Spaggiari traveled to the U.S. and contacted the CIA. According to a confidential source, he had also been in Miami shortly before the heist. The French Le Point and L'Aurore reported that the agency was compelled to pass on its information about Spaggiari to French authorities. In early 1977, Spanish police arrested Jorge Cesarsky of Argentina's fascist terror organization, the AAA, and Carlos Perez, a Miami-based Cuban exile, in connection with a string of murders of young Spanish leftists. According to the Spanish daily El País, Perez and a large number of other Cuban exiles were in Spain as part of a newly created fascist international.
Continuing. In 1976, OAS and Agincourt Press terrorist Jean-Denis Ringard, spelled R-A-I-N-G-E-A-R-D, was in the United States seeking the support of such right-wing leaders as Senator Strom Thurmond of South Carolina for an OAS coup in the Azores in the wake of Portugal's left-wing military revolution. The coup, if successful, would bring a rightist government and U.S. control over the militarily strategic Atlantic archipelago. According to an FBI investigation of Rangiert, on 19th of November 1969, the Bureau had sent Portuguese police a questionnaire on his connection to an OAS front, the Agincourt Press. The questions concerned a prior Rangiert trip to Miami, during which he had a run-in with the law. When asked about Rangiert's troubles, the State Department's Portugal desk officer in 1975, William Kelly, said, quote, "I would prefer not to address the question of the French connection," unquote. What are European fascists doing in Miami before and after major operations? Why are Miami-based Cuban exiles executing contracts on young Spaniards? Why was the main station of the CIA-supported fascist front World Service in Miami? Why did bank robber Spaggiari contact the CIA in the United States? Miami is the center of a huge conspiratorial milieu whose personnel wind through the Bay of Pigs, attempts on Castro's life, the JFK murder, and the Great Heroin Coup, and which is now reaching out with a vengeance to Latin America and Europe. To trace the roots of this milieu, we must refer to the immediate aftermath of World War II, when the CIA began its close cooperation with Adolf Hitler's espionage chief Reinhard Gehlen and the Soviet general Andrei Vlasov of Russia's secret anti-communist spy network. Vlasov's organization was absorbed into Gehlen's, which evolved into a European subsidiary of the CIA. U.S. and German agents mingled in Berlin and West Germany, paving the way for inroads into U.S. intelligence by forming former Nazis, SS agents, and Russian czarists.
Bear in mind now the connections of not only Frank Sturgis, but in particular Theodore Shackley, head of station JM Wave, to the U.S. intelligence operations in Europe and the Gehlen organization in particular. Shackley, of course, a key player now in the Iran-Contra scandal.
Headquarters of the CIA Gehlen-Vlasov Combine, staffed in the mid-50s by 4,000 full-time agents, were in Pulak, near Munich. There Gehlen sang to the tune of more than one piper, having remained in touch with the old Nazi hierarchy relocated in Latin America, whose coordinator, Otto Skorzeny, was in Spain. Skorzeny had infiltrated the Spanish intelligence agency DGS and effectively controlled it single-handedly. With the onset of the Cold War, Gehlen's agents were recruited by the CIA for assignments in the United States, Latin America, and Africa. One agent, reportedly, was Frank Bender, allegedly alias Fritz Schwend, a key figure in the Bay of Pigs invasion. U.S. historian Carl Oglesby sees the origin of much of the CIA's later sinister record in the alliances it forged almost immediately upon its birth with the Gehlen-Vlasov organization and, through Operation Underworld, with the Lansky Crime Syndicate. Quote, "Everything after this," meaning the Gehlen Alliance, "on top of Operation Underworld, was probably just a consequence of this merger. How can a naive, trusting, democratic republic give its secrets to crime and its innermost ear to the spirit of Central European fascism and expect not to see its constitution polluted, its traditions abused, and its consciousness of the surrounding world manipulated ultimately out of all realistic shape?"
Continuing. Well put. Moreover, it is ironical that Europe's contribution to U.S. fascism is now returning home and threatening the continent in a conspiracy supported by U.S. economic and clandestine forces. The forces Oglesby speaks of were united during and after the Bay of Pigs affair, and their bedfellows were big businessmen with their own private interests. The merger was toasted in Miami. The Bay of Pigs invasion itself was not the most important phase in the development. That was CIA station JM Wave and its Operation 40, the agency's secret war on Cuba from the summer of 1961 until the end of 1965, 4 years during which a truly conspiratorial powerhouse was forged in Miami. Station JM Wave was unique in the annals of the CIA, as attested to by then Deputy Director of Intelligence Ray S. Klein. Quote, "It was a real anomaly. It was run as if it were in a foreign country, yet most of our agents were in the state of Florida. People just overlooked the fact that it was a domestic operation," unquote. With the start of its secret war, the new station became the agency's largest and the command post for its anti-Castro operations worldwide. Its annual budget of $50 to $100 million financed the activities of 300 permanent employees, most of them case officers who controlled an additional several thousand Cuban exile operatives. Each major CIA station had at least one case officer assigned to Cuban operations who ultimately reported to Miami. In Europe, all Cuban matters were routed through the Frankfurt station, which in turn reported to J.M. Wave. J.M. Wave covered anything and everything Cuban, wherever in the world it might be. Cuban representatives were shadowed in Japan, and a Cuban exile-led commando unit was sent to Helsinki to sabotage the 1962 International Socialist Youth Conference. As J.M. Wave was closing down in 1967, the agency sent another team of saboteurs to France to contaminate a shipment of lubricant bound for Cuba with a bacterial substance developed under its mind-control project MK-Ultra. When poured in oil, it would ruin motors and other machines. I mention these scattered incidents only to elucidate the situation around the October 1965 murder of the exiled Moroccan opposition leader Mehdi Ben Barka in Paris. Ben Barka must have been J.M. Wave's number two target after Fidel Castro between the fall of 1963 and the end of 1965. I would interrupt and say I think perhaps John Kennedy would have been the number one target, exceeding both Ben Barka and Castro. I think the evidence pointing in that direction is rather compelling. Continuing with Kruger's account. Castro, in 1963, had asked Ben Barka to arrange the first tricontinental... Castro, in 1963, had asked Ben Barka to arrange the first tricontinental congress, which was to be held in Cuba in January of 1966. The conference, aimed at third-world solidarity against U.S. imperialism and support for Castro in Cuba, would signal a major setback for J.M. Wave and the CIA's plans for Latin America, where all the agency's major operations in the 1962 through 6 J.M. Wave era were focused.
In 1963, the agency masterminded a revolution in Honduras, another in the Dominican Republic, and a third in Guatemala. In 1964, it assisted in General Branco's military coup in Brazil. In 1965, the Special Forces joined U.S. Marines in suppressing civil war in the Dominican Republic. And in 1966, the CIA aided and abetted Colonel Onganía's military coup in Argentina. Cuba was an especially hot number in 1965. Led by J.M. Wave personnel, the CIA had planned a new invasion of the island to follow one of its attempts to assassinate Castro. The planners included Howard Hunt and James McCord. Unlike the Bay of Pigs invasion, this time the agency was offering leadership in addition to training and financing. However, one byproduct of the 1965 intervention in the Dominican Republic was the aborting of the plan to invade Cuba. The CIA station, J.M. Wave in particular, must have been anxious to know Ben Barka's plans for the Tricontinental Congress and to sabotage them if possible. And time was running out after Ben Barka's September 1965 visit with Castro. Thus, the key to solving the Ben Barka murder case appears to lie with three men. J.M. Wave Chief Theodore Shackley, Morocco Station Chief Robert Wells, and the head of the CIA station in Frankfurt. CIA contract agent Fernand Legros is also known to have associated with Ben Barka in Geneva. The same Legros, L-E-G-R-O-S, who frequented Miami, the Bahamas, and other spots in the Caribbean. When J.M. Wave was dismantled, Shackley and his staff left Miami for Laos, leaving behind a highly trained army of 6,000 fanatically anti-communist Cubans allied to organized crime and powerful elements of the U.S. far right. In 1966, following the Tricontinental Congress, which proceeded without Ben Barka, a counterfront, the World Anti-Communist League, WACL, was chartered in Seoul, South Korea by hardline reactionaries from the world over. That same year, Agenter Press, sponsored by WACL and the intelligence agencies of the United States, France, and Portugal, was created in Lisbon as a cover for OAS terrorists and other European fascists. led by the Frenchman Yves Guérin-Sérac, its aim was the subversion through espionage, sabotage, and murder of all that the Tricontinental Congress had stood for. In that same period, Cuban exile activist organizations sprouted all over Miami's Little Havana. They spawned, in turn, terrorist subgroups like Alpha 66 and Omega 7, whose more notorious leaders, Guillermo and Ignacio Novo, Orlando Bosch, and Nazario Sergin, had all been trained by the CIA. Between 1965 and 1971, they staged sporadic acts of sabotage and assassinations, with Guillermo Novo repeatedly arrested only to be released each time. Cubans, terrorists among them, were also being paid by Santo Traficante and the syndicate to help spin their intricate U.S. narcotics web. And they also found the time for dirty tricks on behalf of Richard Nixon and his White House staff. However, incidents like Operation Eagle of 1970, when the BNDD, the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, rounded up Cuban exile drug traffickers and found many to have been trained by the CIA, had made the Cubans an increasing embarrassment to the agency. As the 70s began, the CIA's Cubans had become an angry, confused, and divided lot, who felt betrayed by their former employer. Still, they experienced a comeback midway through 1971, when the powers that be, creep in the fore, of course that's the committee to re-elect the president, again sought their services. And in 1973, with the military in power in Chile, they found a new employer in the ruthless Chilean secret police, DINA, D-I-N-A. Other dictators south of the border have followed suit.
Continuing. In 1974 and 5, a reign of terror struck Miami's Cuban community as opponents of Orlando Bosch were liquidated. The campaign continued well into 1976, during which Miami was rocked by over 700 bombings. And that year, there was a notable upsurge in Cuban exile activity beyond the territorial U.S. On April 6th, two Cuban fishing boats were attacked and destroyed, and one fisherman was killed. On April 22nd, a bomb exploded at Cuba's Lisbon embassy, killing two and seriously wounding several others. In June of 1976, in the Dominican Republic town of Bonao, the Cuban Action Movement, the Cuban National Liberation Front, Brigade 2506, F-14, and the Cuban Nationalist Movement merged as Bosch's Coordination of United Revolutionary Organizations, or CORU, C-O-R-U. On July 5th, a bomb exploded at the office of Cuba's UN delegation. On July 9th, another went off at Kingston Airport in Jamaica in baggage about to be loaded onto a Havana-bound Cuban flight. The next day, there was an explosion at the Bridgetown, Barbados office of British West Indian Airways, which also represented Cubana de Aviación. On July 17th, bombs went off in the Cuban airline office and embassy in Bogota, Colombia. On July 23rd, a Cuban technician was killed in Merida, Mexico, trying to stop the abduction of the Cuban attaché. On August 9th, terrorists kidnapped two diplomats assigned to the Cuban embassy in Buenos Aires. On August 18th, a bomb exploded at the Cubana de Aviación office in Panama. On September 21st, Chile's former Secretary of State, Orlando Letelier, and his co-worker, Ronnie Carpen Moffat, were killed in Washington when a bomb decimated their car. On October 6th, yet another explosion gutted a Cuban airliner off Barbados, killing 73. On November 7th, one exploded at the Cubana de Aviación office in Madrid. Finally, on November 9th, kidnapper seized an Argentine employee of the Buenos Aires Cuban embassy. Orlando Bosch's army of anti-Castro Cuban terrorists was responsible for all these acts. When the Cuban airliner went down, Bosch himself was arrested in Venezuela. But the extremists had not waited until 1976 to take part in international terrorist operations. In 1975, 100 anti-Castro Cubans joined European fascists in the Army for the Liberation of Portugal, ELP. From neighboring Spain, the ELP, whose core comprised Agintar Press OAS veterans, attempted to overthrow Portugal's progressive military regime. By the way, once again, the OAS here is not the Organization of American States, but the Secret Army Organization, the group of French fascists who attempted to murder French President Charles de Gaulle in revenge for his having given up Algeria as a French colony. Continuing with the account. The 1975 attempt in Rome on the life of Chilean Christian Democratic Party leader Bernardo Leighton was a joint action of DINA, the youth wing of the Italian Fascist Party, MSI, and anti-Castro Cubans. The 1976 murder of Letelier and Moffat, a DINA CORU job, was planned in Miami. Four of the five Cubans involved in it were CIA veterans of the Bay of Pigs invasion. The Leighton attempt and Letelier murder were each coordinated by the American-Chilean DINA agent, Michael Townley.
Continuing. The common denominator in CORU, as well as Internacional Fascista, a combine of anti-communist extremist organizations chartered at an October 1976 meeting in Rome attended by CORU representatives, appears to have been the CIA, or at least a faction thereof. CORU's headquarters are in Miami. Originally, it was sustained by tight collaboration with the CIA and the Chilean junta's secret police. According to the Cuban former CIA agent Manuel Darmas, the CIA coordinated Dina's acts with Carew's. Dina, of course, the Chilean secret intelligence agency, Carew, the Cuban exile group. According to Manuel Darmas, the CIA coordinated Dina's acts with Carew's and supplied the latter with funds, advisors, and explosives. The head of Dina's Miami-based force was reportedly Eduardo Sepúlveda, the Chilean attaché in Miami and a top dog in Dina. Internacional Fascista is the outgrowth of many years of planning in Madrid by the late Nazi Otto Skorzeny, who in the 50s had worked for the CIA. On its roll are former SS agents, OAS terrorists, hatchet men for Portugal's dreaded secret service, PIDE, terrorists from Spain's Fuerza Nueva, Argentine and Italian fascists, Cuban exiles, French gangsters from SAC, and former CIA agents hardened by terror campaigns in Operation 40, Guatemala, Brazil, and Argentina. Besides Carew, Internacional Fascista's militants have at various times numbered the Army for the Liberation of Portugal, the ELP, and its Agenter Press contingent under Yves Guérin-Sarac. The Italian Ordine Nuovo, led by Salvatore Francia and Pierluigi Concutelli, Spain's Guerrillas of Christ the King, Asociación Anticomunista Ibérica, and Alianza Anticomunista Apostolica, AAA, which is not to be confused with the Argentine AAA that is also represented in Internacional Fascista, and the Paladin Group. SS Colonel Skorzeny was the kingpin of the Paladin mercenary group until his death in 1975. Dr. Gerhard Hartmut von Schubert, formerly of Joseph Goebbels' propaganda ministry, was its operating manager. Headquartered in Albufera, Spain, its actual nerve centers were Skorzeny's export-import offices and cover firm, MC, located at a Madrid address shared with a front for the Spanish intelligence agency, SCOE, under Colonel Eduardo Blanco, and also an office of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. The cozy relationship of Spanish right-wing terrorists with U.S. and Spanish intelligence is further underlined by the SCOE's purchase in the mid-1970s of Werbel's silenced M10 machine pistols. That's Mitch Werbel they're talking about, the Georgia weapons manufacturer and paramilitary trainer. The cozy relationship of Spanish right-wing terrorists with U.S. and Spanish intelligence is further underlined by the SCOE's purchase in the mid-70s of Werbel's silenced M10 machine pistols, prior to which the terrorist weapon had been unavailable in Europe. Shortly thereafter, the M10 turned up in the hands of Spanish and Italian terrorists. A melange of former OAS and SAC figures and West German rightist activities and mercenaries, Paladin joined terrorist actions in Europe, Africa, Latin America, and even Southeast Asia. Along with Italian fascists, Paladin is responsible for the December 17, 1973 bombing of Rome's Fiumicino airport, which claimed 32 lives. On behalf of the Spanish government, Paladin kidnapped and murdered leaders of the Basque ETA, and in 1974-76 engineered some 50 bombings in Basque country.